engine stopped. Vitali pulled the car over, 7 kilometers from the airport, got out, and opened the hood. The chauffeur checked belts and electrical connections. Everything seemed as it should. He got back in and tried to start the car, and nothing happened. He figured out a moment later that the alternator had gone bad, and the car had been running off battery power. He tried the car phone. The battery was completely flat. Alexeyev's transport was just arriving. A staff car provided by the commander of the Moscow Military District motored up to the plane, and the general and his aide got in at once for the ride to the Kremlin. For Alexeyev, the most frightening part of the flight was getting out of the aircraft. He halfway expected to see KGB troops waiting for him instead of the staff car. It would almost have been a relief to be arrested. The general and his aide rode in silence. All their talking had been done on the noisy aircraft, where listening devices could not possibly have worked. Alexeyev noted the empty streets, the absence of trucks, most of them now at the front, even the shorter-than-usual lines outside the food stores. A country at war, he thought. Alexeyev had expected the ride to the Kremlin to seem slow. The reverse was true. Seemingly in the blink of an eye, the car pulled through the Kremlin gates. A sergeant outside the Council of Ministers building pulled open the door, saluting smartly. Alexeyev returned it and walked up the steps to the door, where another sergeant waited. Alexeyev walked like a soldier, back straight, his face set in a stern mien. His newly polished boots glistened, and his eyes caught the flashing reflection of the ceiling lights as he walked into the lobby. The general disdained the elevator, preferring the stairs for the trip to the conference room. He noted that the building had been repaired since the bombing incident. A captain of the Taman Guards, the ceremonial unit stationed at Alabino outside Moscow, met the general at the top of the stairs and escorted him to the double doors of the conference room. Alexeyev ordered his aide to wait as he entered, his visored cap tucked tightly under his arm. "Comrades, General Colonel P. L. Alexeyev reports as ordered."
"Welcome to Moscow, Comrade General," the defense minister said. "What is the situation in Germany?"
"Both sides are exhausted but still fighting. The current tactical situation is one of stalemate. We have more troops and weapons available, but we are critically short of fuel."
"Can you win?" the General Secretary asked.
"Yes, Comrade Secretary. Given several days to organize my forces, and if I can do some crucial work with the arriving reserve formations, I think it likely that we can sunder the NATO front."
"Likely? Not certain?" the Defense Minister asked.
"In war there is no certainty," Alexeyev answered simply.
"We have learned that," the Foreign Minister answered dryly. "Why have we not won yet?"
"Comrades, we failed initially to achieve strategic and tactical surprise. Surprise is the most important variable factor in war. With it, we would probably, almost certainly, have succeeded in 2 or 3 weeks."
"To achieve certain success now, what else will you need?"
"Comrade Defense Minister, I need the support of the people and the party. And I need a little time."
"You evade the question," Marshal Bukharin said.
"We were never allowed to use our chemical weapons in the initial assault. That could have been a decisive advantage."
"The political cost of those weapons was deemed too great," the Foreign Minister said defensively.
"Could you make profitable use of them now?" the General Secretary asked.
"I think not. Those weapons should have been used from the first on equipment storage depots. The depots are now mainly empty, and hitting them would have only a limited effect. Use of chemicals at the front is no longer a viable option. The newly arriving sea formations lack the modern equipment necessary to operate efficiently in a chemical environment."
"Again, I ask the question," the Defense Minister repeated. "What do you need to make victory certain?" "To achieve a decisive breakthrough, we need to be able to blast a hole in NATO lines at least 30 kilometers wide and 20 kilometers in depth. To do that, I need 10 full-strength divisions online ready to advance. I need several days to prepare that force."
How about tactical nuclear weapons? Alexeyev's face did not change.
Are you mad, Comrade General Secretary?
The risks are high.
There's a prize understatement.
And if we can prevent, politically, NATO retaliation, Defense asked.
I do not know how that is possible.
And neither do you.
But if we can make it possible?
Then it would increase our chances measurably. Alexeyev paused, inwardly chilled at what he saw in those faces. They want to use nuclear weapons at the front. And when NATO responds in kind and vaporizes my troops, then what? Will it stop with a single exchange, or will more and more be used, the explosions advancing west and east? If I tell them they are crazy, they will find a general who will not.
The problem is one of control, comrades.
Explain.
If he were to stay alive and prevent this, Alexeyev spoke carefully, mixing truth and lies and guesses. Dissimulation did not come easily to the general, but at least this was an issue he had discussed with his peers for over a decade.
Comrade General Secretary,
nuclear weapons are foremost political weapons for both sides, controlled by political leaders. This limits their battlefield utility. A decision to use an atomic warhead in a tactical environment must be passed on by those leaders. By the time approval is granted, the tactical situation will almost certainly have changed, and the weapon is no longer useful. NATO never has seemed to grasp this. The weapons they have are mainly designed to be used by battlefield commanders, yet I have never thought myself that NATO's political leadership would lightly give use authority to those battlefield commanders. Because of this, the weapons they would more probably use against us are actually strategic weapons aimed at strategic targets, not the tactical weapons in the field.
Well, that is not what they say, Defense objected.
You will note that when we made our breakthroughs at Alfeld and Rula, nuclear weapons were not used on the bridgeheads, even though some pre-war NATO writings would seem to suggest they should have been. I conclude that there are more variable factors in the equation than were fully appreciated. We have learned ourselves that the reality of war can be different from the theory of war.
So you support our decision to use tactical nuclear weapons? The foreign minister asked.
No.
The lie rolled off his lips.
If you are certain that you can prevent retaliation, of course I support it. I caution you, however, that my reading of NATO's response might be very different from what we might otherwise expect.
I would expect retaliation to fall some hours later than we think, and against strategic rather than tactical targets. They are more likely to hit road and rail junctions, airfields, and supply facilities. These do not move. Our tanks do.
Think on what I just said, comrades. Things will quickly go out of control. Make peace, you fools.
So you think we could use tactical weapons with impunity, if we simultaneously threaten strategic targets of our own?
The General Secretary asked, hopefully.
That is essentially the NATO pre-war doctrine. It overlooks the fact that the use of nuclear weapons over friendly territory is not something undertaken lightly. Comrades, I warn you that the prevention of a NATO response will not be an easy exercise.
You worry about the battlefield, Comrade General, the Defense Minister suggested lightly. We will worry about the political questions.
There was only one more thing he could say to discourage them.
Very well. In that case, I will need direct control of the weapons.
Why? The General Secretary demanded.
So they won't be fired, you fucking idiot.
We have here a question of practicality. Targets will appear and disappear on a minute-to-minute basis. If you want me to blast a hole in NATO lines with atomic arms, I will not have the time to get your approval.
Alexeyev was horrified to see that even this did not dissuade them.
How many would you need? The defense minister wanted to know.
That is a question contingent upon the time and place of the breakthrough operation, and we would use small weapons against discrete point targets,
not population centers. I would say a maximum of 30 weapons in the 5 to 10 kiloton range. We would launch them with free-flight artillery rockets.
How soon will you be ready for your attack? Marshal Bukharin asked.
That depends on how quickly I can get veteran troops into the new divisions. If these reservists are to survive on the battlefield, we must get experienced men to firm up their ranks.
A good idea, Comrade General, the Defense Minister approved. We will not detain you further. In 2 days, I want to see detailed plans for your breakthrough.
The 5 members of the Defense Council watched Alexeyev salute, pivot on his heels, and depart. Kossoff looked up at Marshal Bukharin.
And you wanted to replace this man?
The General Secretary agreed.
That's the first real fighting soldier I've seen in years.
Alexeyev waved for Major Sergeyev to follow him. Only he felt the cold lead weight in his belly. Only he knew how weak his knees were as they trod down the marble steps. Alexeyev didn't believe in God, but he knew that he had just seen the door to hell cracked open.
"Major," he said casually as they entered the staff car, "since we're in Moscow, perhaps you would like to visit your father, the minister, before we return to the front."
"That's very kind of you, Comrade General."
"You have earned it, Comrade Major. Besides, I want figures on our oil supply."
The driver would report what he'd heard, of course.
"They want me to use nuclear weapons at the front," Alexeyev whispered as soon as the minister's door was closed.
"Yes, I was afraid of that."
"They must be stopped. There is no predicting what catastrophe this could bring about."
"The defense minister says that a tactical nuclear environment could easily be controlled."
"He's talking like one of those NATO idiots. There is no wall between a tactical and a strategic nuclear exchange. Just a fuzzy line in the imagination of the amateurs and academics who advise their political leaders. The only thing that would then stand between us and a nuclear holocaust, our survival would be at the mercy of whichever NATO leader is the least stable."
"What did you tell them?" the minister asked.
Had Alexeyev retained his wits enough to say the right thing? "I must be alive to stop them. I told them it's a wonderful idea." The general sat down. "I also told them that I must have tactical control of the weapons. I think they will agree to that. I'll make sure those weapons are never used. I have just the man on my staff to do that, too."
"You agree, then, that the Defense Council must be stopped?"
"Yes." The general looked down at the floor, then back up. "Otherwise, I don't know. It is possible that their plan might start something that no one could stop. If we die, we die in a good cause."
"How do we stop them?"
"When does the Politburo meet?"
"Every day now. We usually meet at 9:30.
"Whom can we trust?"
"Kossoff is with us."
"There will be a few others, Politburo members, but I don't know whom I can approach."
"Wonderful. Our only certain ally is the KGB.
I need some time.
Perhaps this will help."
Sergeyev handed over a file he'd gotten from Kossoff. "Here is a list of officers in your command who are suspected of political unreliability." Alexeyev scanned the list. He recognized the names of 3 men who had served with distinction in battalion and regimental commands. 1 good staff officer, and 1 terrible one. "Even when my men fight a war for the motherland, they are under suspicion." "I am supposed to formulate my attack plan before I return to the front. I will be at Army headquarters."
"Good luck, Pavel Leonidovich."
"And to you, Mikhail Eduardovich." The general watched father and son embrace. He wondered what his own father would think of this. To whom do I turn for guidance? Keflavik, Iceland.
"Good afternoon. I am Major General William Emerson. This is Colonel Lowe."
He will act as interpreter.
General Major Andreev, I speak English.
Do you propose a surrender? Emerson asked.
I propose that we negotiate, Andreev answered.
I require that your forces cease hostilities at once and surrender their weapons.
And what will become of my troops?
They will be interned as prisoners of war. Your wounded will receive proper medical attention, and your men will be treated in accordance with the usual international conventions.
How do I know you speak truly?
You do not.
Andreev noted the blunt, honest answer. But what choice do I have?
I propose a ceasefire, he checked his watch, at 15 hours.
Agreed.
Brussels, Belgium.
How long? Sakyer asked.
3 days. We'll be able to attack with 4 divisions.
What's left of 4 divisions, Sakyer thought.
We've stopped them, all right. But what do we have to drive them back with? They did have confidence. NATO had begun the war with an advantage only in its technology, which was even more pronounced now. The Russian stocks of new tanks and guns had been ravaged, and the divisions coming into the line now had 20-year-old cast-offs. They still had numbers, though, and any offensive Sakyer planned would have to be carefully planned and executed. Only in the air did he have an important advantage, and air power had never won a war. The Germans were pushing hard for a counterstrike. Too much of their land and too many of their citizens were on the wrong side of the line. Already the Bundeswehr was probing aggressively on several fronts, but they'd have to wait. The German army was not strong enough to push forward alone. They'd taken too many losses in their prime role of stopping the Soviet advance. Kazan, RSFSR. The youngsters were too excited to sleep. The older men were too worried to sleep. Conditions didn't help. The men of the 77th Motor Rifle Division were crammed into passenger cars, and while all had seats, it was at the cost of rubbing against their comrades even as they breathed. The troop trains moved along at a speed of 100 kilometers per hour. The tracks were set in the Russian way, with the rail segments ending together instead of offset. So instead of the clickety-click familiar to Western riders, the men of this C Division heard only a series of thuds. It tested nerves already raw. The interval between the jarring sounds slowed. A few soldiers looked out to see that their train was stopping at Kazan. The officers were surprised. They weren't supposed to stop until they got to Moscow. The mystery was soon solved. No sooner had the 20-car train stopped than new men filed into the carriages.
"Attention!" called one loud voice. "Combat soldiers arriving!"
Though they had been issued new uniforms, their boots showed the weeks of abuse. Their swagger marked them as veterans. About 20 got onto each passenger car and rapidly secured comfortable seating for themselves. Those displaced would have to stand. There were officers, too, and they found their counterparts. The officers of the 77th began to get first-hand information of NATO doctrine and tactics. What worked and what didn't work. All the lessons paid for in blood by the soldiers who did not join the division at Kazan. The enlisted men got no such lessons. They watched men who were able to sleep, even as they rode to the fighting front. Faslane, Scotland. Chicago was alongside the pier, loading torpedoes and missiles for her next mission. Half her crew was ashore, stretching their legs and buying drinks for the crew of Torbay. Their boat had acquired quite a reputation for her work in the Barents Sea, enough so that they'd be heading back as soon as she was ready, to escort the carrier battle groups now in the Norwegian Sea, heading for the Soviet bases on the Kola Peninsula. McCafferty sat alone in his stateroom, wondering why a mission that had ended in disaster was considered successful, hoping that he wouldn't be sent out again, but knowing that he would. Moscow, RSFSR.
Good news, Comrade General.
The colonel stuck his head in the office Alexeyev had taken for himself.
Your people were able to join up with the 77th at Kazan.
Thank you. Alexeyev's head went back to his maps when the colonel withdrew.
It's amazing.
What's that, Vanya?
The men you selected for the 77th, the paperwork, the orders, they went through just like that.
A routine transfer of personnel, why shouldn't it go through? The general asked.
The Politburo approved the procedure.
But this is the only group of men flown out.
They had the farthest to go.
Alexeyev held up a message form he'd just filled out.
Captain.
No, now he was Major Arkady Semyonovich Sorokin of the 76th Guards Airborne Division, was ordered to report to Moscow immediately. He would fly also. A pity he could not have the captain bring some of his men along, but they were where no Soviet general could reach.
So, Mikhail Eduardovich, what does General Alexeyev plan?
Sergeyev handed over some notes. Kossoff leafed through the pages in a few minutes.
If he succeeds, at least an order of Lenin from us, yes?
That general is overly smart. Too bad for him.
We are far from that point.
What about the timing?
We depend on you to set the stage.
I have a colonel who specializes in this sort of thing.
I'm sure.
One other thing we should do, Kossoff said. He explained for several minutes before taking his leave. Sergeyev shredded the notes he had from Alexeyev and had Vitali burn them.
The trouble light and buzzer caught the dispatcher's attention at once. Something was wrong with the trackage on the Elektrozavodskaya Bridge, 3 kilometers east of Kazan Station.
Get an inspector out there.
There's a train 0.5 kilometer away, his assistant warned.
Tell it to stop at once.
The dispatcher flipped the switch controlling the tower signal.
The deputy dispatcher lifted his radio telephone.
Train 1191, this is Kazan Central Dispatch. Trouble on the bridge ahead. Stop immediately.
I see the signal. Stopping now, the engineer replied.
We won't make it.
And he couldn't. 1191 was a 100-car unit, flat cars loaded with armored vehicles and box cars loaded with munitions. Sparks flew in the pre-dawn light as the engineer applied the brakes on every car. But he needed more than a few hundred meters to halt the train. He peered ahead looking for the problem. A bad signal, he hoped.
No, a track was loose just at the west side of the bridge. The engineer shouted a warning to his crew and cringed. The locomotive jumped the track and ground sideways to a halt. This could not prevent the 3 engines behind it and 8 flat cars from surging forward. They too jumped off the track, and only the bridge's steel framework prevented them from spilling into the Yauza River. The track inspector arrived a minute later. He cursed all the way to the telephone box.
We need 2 big wreckers here.
How bad? The dispatcher asked.
Not as bad as the one last August.
12 hours, perhaps 16.
What went wrong?
All the traffic on this bridge, what do you think?
Anyone hurt?
Don't think so. They weren't going very fast.
I'll have a crew out there in 10 minutes.
The dispatcher looked up at the blackboard list of arriving trains.
Damn, what are we going to do with these?
We can't split them up. It's a whole army division traveling as a unit. They were supposed to go around the north side. We can't send them around to the south either. Novodanilovsky Bridge is packed solid for hours.
Reroute them into Kursk Station. I'll call the Rzhevskaya dispatcher and see if he can get us a routing on his track.
The trains arrived at 7:30. One by one they were shunted onto the sidings at Kursk Station and stopped. Many of the troops aboard had never been to Moscow before, but except for those on the outermost sidings, all they could see were the trains of their fellow soldiers.
A deliberate attempt to sabotage the state railroads, the KGB colonel said.
More probably it was worn trackage, comrade, the Kazan dispatcher said. But you are correct to be prudent.
Worn trackage? The colonel snarled.
He knew for certain that it had been a different cause.
I think perhaps you do not take this seriously enough.
The dispatcher's blood chilled at that statement.
I have my responsibilities, too. For the moment that means clearing the wreckage off that damned bridge and getting my trains rolling again.
Now I have a 7-train unit sitting at Kursk, and unless I can get them moving north... From what I see of your map, moving all the traffic around the city's northern perimeter depends on a single switch.
Well, yes, but that's the responsibility of the Rzhevskaya dispatcher.
Has it ever occurred to you that saboteurs are not assigned in the same way as dispatchers? Perhaps the same man could operate in a different district. Has anyone checked that switch?
I don't know.
Well, find out.
No, no, I will send my own people to check before you railroad fools wreck anything else.
But my scheduling.
The dispatcher was a proud man, but he knew that he had pressed his luck too far already.
Welcome to Moscow, Alexeyev said genially. Major Arkady Semyonovich Sorokin was short, like most paratroop officers. A handsome young man with light brown hair, his blue eyes burned for a reason that Alexeyev understood better than the major did. He limped slightly from two bullets he'd taken in the leg during the initial assault on the Keflavik airbase on Iceland. On his breast was the ribbon of the Order of the Red Banner, earned for leading his company into enemy fire. Sorokin and most of the early casualties had been flown out for medical treatment. He and they were now awaiting new assignments since their division had been captured on Iceland.
"How may I serve the general?" Sorokin asked.
"I need a new aide, and I prefer officers with combat experience. More than that, Arkady Semyonovich, I will need you to perform a delicate task. But before we discuss that, there is something I need to explain to you. Please sit down."
"Your leg?"
"The doctors advised me not to run on it for another week. They were right. I tried to do my 10 kilometers yesterday and pulled up lame after only 2.
He didn't smile.
Alexeyev imagined that the boy hadn't smiled at all since May. The general explained to him for the first time why this was true. 5 minutes later, Sorokin's hand was opening and closing beside the arm of the leather chair, about where his pistol holster would be if he'd been standing.
"Major, the essence of a soldier is discipline," Alexeyev concluded. "I have brought you here for a reason, but I must know that you will carry out your orders exactly. I will understand if you cannot."
There was no emotion on his face at all, but the hand relaxed.
"Yes, Comrade General. And I thank you from my soul for bringing me here. It will be exactly as you say."
"Come, then. We have work to do."
The general's car was already waiting. Alexeyev and Sorokin drove to the inner ring road around central Moscow that changes its name every few kilometers. It is called Chkalova, where it passes the Star Theater toward the Kursk railroad station. The commander of the 77th Motor Rifle Division was dozing. He had a new deputy commander, a brigadier from the front, to replace the overaged colonel who had held the post. They had talked for 10 hours on NATO tactics, and now the generals were taking advantage of their unexpectedly extended stop in Moscow to get some sleep.
"What the hell is this?"
The 77th's commander opened his eyes to see a 4-star general staring down at him. He jumped to attention like a cadet.
"Good morning, Comrade General."
"And good morning to you.
What the hell is a division of the Soviet Army doing asleep on a goddamned railroad siding while men are dying in Germany?"
Alexeyev nearly screamed at the man.
We can't make the trains move. There is some problem with the tracks."
"There is a problem with the tracks?
You have your vehicles, don't you?"
"The train goes to Kiev Station, where we switch locomotives for the trip to Poland."
"I'll arrange transport for you."
"We don't have time," Alexeyev explained, as though to a wayward child, "to have a fighting division sit on its ass. If the train can't move, you can. Roll your vehicles off the flat cars. We'll take you through Moscow, and you can get to Kiev Station yourself. Now, rub the sleep out of your eyes and get this division rolling before I find someone else who can."
It never failed to amaze the general what a little screaming could do. Alexeyev watched the division commander scream at his regimental commanders, who went off to scream at their battalion commanders. In 10 minutes, the screaming was done at the squad level. 10 minutes after that, the tie-down chains were being stripped off the BTR-60 infantry carriers, and the first of them rolled off the back of the train for assembly in Korskogo Square in front of the station. The infantrymen mounted their vehicles, looking very dangerous in battle dress, their weapons in their hands.
"You got your new communications officers?" Alexeyev asked.
Yes, they have completely replaced my own people, the division commander nodded.
Good. We've learned the hard way about communication security at the front. Your new men will serve you well.
And the new riflemen?
One company of veterans in each regiment, plus others spread individually throughout the rifle companies.
The commander was also pleased to have some new combat officers to replace a few of his less well-regarded subordinates. Alexeyev had clearly sent him good ones.
Good. Get your division formed up in columns of regiments.
Let's show the people something, comrade.
Show them what a Soviet army division is supposed to look like. They need it.
How do we proceed through the city?
I have gotten some KGB border guards for traffic control. Keep your people in proper order. I don't want anyone to get lost.
A major came running up.
Ready to move in 20 minutes.
15, the commander insisted.
Very good, Alexeyev observed.
General, I will accompany you. I want to see how familiar your men are with their equipment.
Mikhail Sergeyev arrived early for the Politburo meeting, as was his habit. The usual complement of Kremlin guards was about one company of infantry with light arms. They were from the Taman Guards Division, ceremonial troops with minimal weapons training. A praetorial guard without teeth. Like many ceremonial units, they practiced parading and boot shining and looking like soldiers. Though at Alabino they did have a full divisional set of tanks and guns. The real Kremlin guardians were the KGB border guards and the division of MVD troops garrisoned outside Moscow. It was typical of the Soviet system that there would be three armed formations loyal to three separate ministries. The Taman division had the best weapons but the least training. The KGB had the best training but only light weapons. The MVD, which answered to the Ministry of the Interior, was also short on weapons and trained mainly as a paramilitary police force. But they were composed of Tartars, troops of known ferocity and antipathy toward the ethnic Russian people. The relationship among the three was more than merely complex.
Mikhail Edvardovich?
Ah,
it was the agriculture minister.
Good morning, Filip Moisevich.
I am worried, the man said quietly.
About what?
I fear the Defense Council may be thinking about atomic weapons.
They cannot be so desperate.
If you are an agent provocateur, comrade, you know that I've been told this. Better that I should know now what you are.
The man's open Slavic face did not change.
I hope you are right. I have not managed to feed this country for once to see someone blow it up.
An ally, Sergeyev told himself.
If they put it to a vote, what then?
I don't know, Misha. I wish I did. Too many of us are being swept away by events.
Will you speak out against this madness?
Yes. I will soon have a grandchild, and he will have a country to grow up in, even if it means my life.
Forgive me, comrade. Forgive me for all the things I have thought of you before.
Always the early bird, Mikhail Edvardovich?
Kossoff and the defense minister arrived together.
Philip and I had to discuss fuel allocations for food transport.
You worry about my tanks. Food can wait.
Defense walked past them into the conference room. Sergeyev and his compatriot shared a look. The meeting came to order 10 minutes later. The general secretary began it, immediately turning over discussions to defense.
We must make a decisive move in Germany.
You have been promising us one of those for weeks, Bromkovsky said.
This time it will work. General Alexeyev will be here in an hour to present his plan. For the moment, we will discuss the use of tactical nuclear weapons at the front and how to prevent a NATO nuclear response.
Sergeyev's was one of the impassive faces at the table. He counted four who displayed obvious horror. The discussion that followed was spirited. Alexeyev rode with the division commander for the first few kilometers, past the Indian embassy and the justice ministry. The latter drew an ironic look from the general. How fitting that I should pass that building today. The command vehicle was essentially a radio with 8 wheels. 6 communications officers rode in the back to allow the commander to run his division right from here. The communications officers were from the front, and loyal to the combat officers who'd brought them back. Progress was slow.
The combat vehicles were designed for speed, but speed also made for breakdowns. And at anything over 20 kilometers per hour, the tanks would tear the pavement apart. As it was, they motored along placidly, attracting small knots of people who watched and waved and cheered as the soldiers passed. The procession was not as precise as one of the parades for which the Taman guards practiced every day. If anything, this made the people more enthusiastic.
Here were real soldiers going to the front. KGB officers stood along the route, advising the officers of the Moscow militia to let the division pass. They'd explained the reason, the foul-up in the Eastern Rail Network, and the traffic policemen were only too happy to make way for the soldiers of the motherland. Alexeyev stood up in the gunner's hatch as the column reached Nogina Square. "You've done well to get your men to this level of training," he told the divisional commander. "I want to dismount and see how the rest of your troops are doing. I will see you again at Stendal." Alexeyev told the driver not to stop. He jumped off the command vehicle carrier with the agility of a young corporal and stood in the street, waving the vehicles past, saluting the officers who rode proudly in their vehicles. It was 5 minutes until the 2nd Regiment reached him, and he waited for its 2nd Battalion. Major Sorokin was in the battalion command vehicle and leaned over to grasp the general's hand and pull him up off the street.
"An old man like you could get hurt that way, Comrade General," Sorokin warned.
"You young buck!" Alexeyev was proud of his physical condition. He looked at the battalion commander, a man newly arrived from the front. "Ready?"
"I am ready, Comrade General."
"Remember your orders and keep control of your men." Alexeyev pulled the flap loose on his holster. Sorokin had himself an AK-47 rifle. He could see St. Basil's now, the collection of towers and onion domes at the end of Razina Street. One by one, the procession of vehicles turned right past the old cathedral. Behind him, the soldiers in the infantry carriers all had their heads up looking at the sights. This was the oldest model of the BTR and lacked overhead cover. "There," Alexeyev said to himself. "The gate built by Ivan the Terrible that led right to the Council of Ministers building. Just through the gate under the clock tower. The time was 10:20. He was 10 minutes early for his appointment with the Politburo.
"Are we all crazy?" the agriculture minister asked. "Do we think we can gamble with atomic arms like so many firecrackers?"
A good man, Sergeyev thought, but he has never been an eloquent one. The petroleum minister rubbed sweaty hands over his trouser legs.
"Comrade Defense Minister, you have led us to the brink of destruction," Bromkovsky said. "Now you wish us to leap in after you."
"It is too late to stop," the general secretary said. "The decision has been made." An explosion gave the lie to that statement.
"Now," Alexeyev said.
In the back of the command vehicle, the communications officers activated the divisional radio net and announced an explosion in the Kremlin. A battalion of riflemen under General Alexeyev's personal command was going in to investigate. Alexeyev was already moving. 3 BTRs ran through the smashed gate, stopping at the front steps of the Council of Ministers building.
"What the hell's going on here?" Alexeyev screamed at the captain of the Taman Guards.
"I don't know. You can't be here. You are not allowed. You must—"
Sorokin cut him down with a 3-round burst. He jumped down off the vehicle, nearly collapsing on his bad leg, and raced for the building, with the general in pursuit. Alexeyev turned at the door.
"Secure the area. There is a plot to kill the Politburo."
The order was relayed to the arriving troops. Taman Guard troops were running across the open spaces from the old arsenal building. A few warning shots were fired. The guards wavered. Then a lieutenant fired a full magazine from his rifle, and a firefight began within the Kremlin walls. 2 bodies of Soviet soldiers, only 10 of whom really knew what was happening, began exchanging fire while members of the Politburo watched from the windows. Alexeyev hated Sorokin for taking the lead, but the major knew whose life was more profitably risked. He encountered a guards captain on the 2nd floor landing and killed him. He kept going up, with Alexeyev and the battalion commander behind, remembering the diagram of the building's fourth floor. Another soldier, this one a major, was there with a rifle. He managed to get one burst off, missing high as his target dove, but the major of paratroops rolled clear and killed him. The conference room was only 20 meters away. They found a colonel of the KGB who held his hands out in the clear. "Where is Alexeyev?" "Here." The general had his pistol in his hand. "No more guards alive on this floor," the Czechist said. He'd just killed 4 with a silenced automatic hidden under his tunic. "Door." Alexeyev motioned Sorokin. He didn't kick it down, it was unlocked, and led into an anteroom. The double oak doors beyond led to the Politburo. Sorokin went through first. They found 21 old and middle-aged men, mainly standing at the windows, watching a small infantry engagement that had about run its course. The Taman guards stationed throughout the Kremlin grounds were not organized for this sort of assault, and had not the smallest chance of overwhelming a company of experienced riflemen. Alexeyev came in next, holstering his pistol. "Comrades, please go back to your seats. Evidently there is a plot to seize the Kremlin. Fortunately, I was just arriving for my appointment when this column of troops passed by." "Sit down, comrades," the general ordered. "What the hell is going on here?" the defense minister asked. "When I entered military school 34 years ago, I swore an oath to defend the state and the party from all enemies," Alexeyev said coldly, "including those who would kill my country because they don't know what the hell else to do. Comrade Sergeyev?" The petroleum minister pointed to 2 men. "You, comrades, and Comrade Kossov will stay. The others will be leaving with me in a few minutes."
"Alexeyev, you have signed your own death warrant," the Minister of the Interior said. He reached for a telephone. Major Sorokin lifted his rifle and destroyed the phone with a single round. "Do not make that mistake again. We can very easily kill you all. That would be much more convenient than what we have in mind." Alexeyev waited for a moment. Another officer ran into the room and nodded. "We will now leave, comrades. If one of you attempts to speak to anyone, you will all be killed immediately. 2 by 2, start moving." The KGB colonel, who had just set off his second Kremlin bomb, took out the first group. After they left, Sergeyev and Kossov came up to the general.
"Well done," said the director of the KGB. "Things are ready at Lefortovo. The men on duty are all mine."
"We're not going to Lefortovo. A change in plans," Alexeyev said. "They go to the old airport, and after that I helicopter them to a military camp commanded by someone I trust."
"But I have it all arranged."
"I'm sure you do. This is my new aide, Major Sorokin. Major Sergeyev is at that camp right now, making final arrangements."
"Tell me, Comrade Director, does Sorokin look familiar to you?"
He did look vaguely familiar, but Kossov couldn't place him.
"He was a captain, since promoted for bravery, in the 76th Guards Airborne Division."
"Yes." Kossov sensed the danger, but not the reason.
"Major Sorokin had a daughter in the Young Octoberists. 76th Airborne is home-based at Pskov," Alexeyev explained.
"For my little Svetlana," Sorokin said, "who died without a face."
All Kossov had time to see was a rifle and a white flash. Sergeyev leaped out of the way and looked to Alexeyev in shock.
"Even if you were right to trust the Czechist, I will not take orders from one. I leave you with a company of loyal troops. I must get control of the army. Your job is to get control of the party apparatus."
"How can we trust you now?" Agriculture asked.
"By now we should be on our way to control of the communications lines. All will be done in accordance with our plan. They will announce an attempt to topple the government, prevented by loyal troops. Later today one of you will appear on television. I must go. Good luck." Directed by their KGB guides, the motorized battalions headed for the television and radio stations, and the main telephone exchanges.
They moved rapidly now, responding to emergency calls to secure the city against an unknown number of counter-revolutionaries. In fact, they had not the least idea what they were doing, only that they had orders from a 4-star general. That was enough for the officers of the 77th Motor Rifle. The communications teams had done well. The division political officer appeared at the Council of Ministers building to find 4 Politburo members on the telephones giving orders. All was not as it should be, but the party men seemed to have things under control. The other members, he learned, had all been killed or wounded in a vicious attack by the Kremlin guards themselves. The director of the KGB had detected the plot barely in time to summon loyal troops, but died heroically resisting the attackers. None of this made much sense to the divisional Zampolit, but it didn't have to. His orders made perfectly good sense, and he radioed instructions to the divisional commander. Sergeyev was surprised at how easy it was. The number of people who actually knew what had happened was under 200. The fighting had all taken place within the Kremlin walls, and while many had heard the noise, the cover story explained it well enough for the moment. He had several friends in the Central Committee, and they did what they were told in the emergency. By the end of the day, the reins of power were shared among 3 party men. The other Politburo members were under armed guard outside the city, with Major Sorokin in charge of their care. Without instructions from the Minister of the Interior, the MVD troops took their orders from the Politburo, while the KGB wavered leaderless. It was the final irony of the Soviet system that, headless, it could not save itself. The Politburo's pervasive control of all aspects of Soviet life prevented people now from asking the questions that had to be asked before any organized resistance could begin. And every hour gave Sergeyev and his clique more time to consolidate their rule. He had the aged but distinguished Pyotr Bromkovsky to head the party apparatus and act as defense minister. Remembered in the army as a commissar who cared about the men he served with, Petya was able to anoint Alexeyev as deputy defense minister and chief of the general staff. Filip Moiseyevich Krylov retained agriculture and acquired internal affairs. Sergeyev would be acting general secretary. The 3 men formed a troika, which would appeal to their countrymen until more of their people could be brought in. 1 paramount task remained. Chapter 43. A Walk in the Woods. The last chapter. Brussels, Belgium. There is no more natural fear than of the unknown, and the greater the unknown, the greater had to be the fear. Sackyer had 4 intelligence reports side by side on his desk. The only thing they agreed on was that they did not know what was happening, but that it might be bad. For that I need an expert, Sackyer thought. A snippet of information from a Ferret satellite had given him the word that there was some fighting in Moscow, and told him of the movement of troops to communications centers. But state television and radio had kept to a normal schedule for 12 hours, until a news broadcast at 5 in the morning, Moscow time, had broken the official word. An attempted coup d'etat by the defense minister? That would not be good news, and the fact that it had been put down was only marginally better. The monitoring stations had just heard a brief speech by Pyotr Bromkovsky, known as the last of the Stalinist hardliners. Maintain calm and keep your faith in the party. What the hell did that mean, Sackyer wondered. I need information, he told his intelligence chief. What do we know about the Russian command structure? Alexeyev, the new commando west, is evidently not at his command post. Good news for us, since we have our attack scheduled in 10 hours. Sackyer's phone buzzed. I told you no calls. Go ahead, Franz. 4 hours? Potsdam. No reply yet. I'll be back to you in a little while. He hung up. We just received an open radio message that the Soviet chief of staff urgently wishes to meet with me in Potsdam. Urgently wishes, Herr General? That's what the message said. I can come by helicopter, and they'll provide a helicopter escort to a meeting place. Sackyer leaned back. You suppose they want to shoot me down because I've done such a great job? The Supreme Allied Commander Europe allowed himself an ironic smile. We have their troops massing northeast of Hanover, the chief of intelligence pointed out.
I know, Joachim. Don't go, the intel chief said. Send a representative.
Why didn't he ask for that? Sakyor wondered. That's the way it's normally done.
He's in a hurry, Joachim said. They haven't won. They haven't really lost anything yet, but their advance has been stopped, and they still have their fuel problems. What if a wholly new power block has taken over in Moscow? They shut down the news media while they try to consolidate power, and they will want to terminate hostilities. They don't need the distraction. A good time to push hard, he concluded.
When they're desperate? Sakyor asked.
They still have plenty of nukes. Any unusual patterns of Soviet activity? Anything that even looks unusual?
Aside from the newly arriving reserve divisions, no.
What if I can stop this damned war?
I'm going.
Sakyor lifted his phone and informed the Secretary General of the North Atlantic Council of his decision. It was easy to be nervous with a pair of Russian attack choppers flying in close formation. Sakyor resisted the temptation to look out the windows at them, and concentrated instead on the intelligence folders. He had the official NATO intel dossiers for 5 senior Soviet commanders. He didn't know who it might be that he was meeting. His aide sat across from the general. He was looking out the windows. Potsdam, German Democratic Republic. Alexeyev paced the ground, nervous to have to be away from Moscow, where the new party bosses, but party bosses nonetheless, he reminded himself, were trying to pull things together. That idiot asked how they could trust me, he thought. He reviewed the briefing information on his NATO counterpart. Age 59. Son and grandson of a soldier. Father a paratroop officer killed by the Germans west of St. Vite during the Battle of the Bulge. West Point, 15th in his class. Vietnam, 4 tours of duty, last as commander of the 101st Airborne. Regarded by the North Vietnamese as an unusually dangerous and innovative tactician. He'd proved that, Alexeyev grunted to himself. University master's degree in international relations, supposed to be gifted in languages. Married, 2 sons and a daughter, none of them in uniform. Someone decided that 3 generations was enough, Alexeyev thought. 4 grandchildren. 4 grandchildren. When a man has grandchildren. Enjoys gambling with cards, only known vice. Moderate drinker. No known sexual deviations, the report said. Alexeyev smiled at that. We're both too old for that nonsense. And who has the time? The sound of helicopter rotors filtered through the trees. Alexeyev stood in a small clearing next to a command vehicle. The crew was in the trees along with a platoon of riflemen. It was unlikely, but NATO could seize this opportunity to attack and kill. No, we're not that crazy, and neither are they, the general told himself. It was one of their new Blackhawks. The helicopter flared and settled gracefully to the grassy meadow, with the pair of Mi-24s circling overhead. The door didn't open at once. The pilot killed his engines, and the rotor took 2 minutes to slow to a complete stop. Then the door slid open, and the general stepped out hatless. Tall for a paratrooper, Alexeyev thought. Sakyor could have brought the bone-handled .45 Colt that he'd been given in Vietnam, but he judged it better to impress the Russian by coming unarmed in ordinary fatigues. 4 black stars adorned his collar, and the badges of a master parachutist and combat infantryman were sewn on his left breast. On the right side was a simple name tag, Robinson. I don't have to show off, Ivan. I've won. Tell the men in the woods to stand down and withdraw.
But, Comrade General!
It was a new aide, and he didn't know his general yet. Quickly. If I need an interpreter, I will wave. Alexeyev walked toward the NATO commander. The aides gravitated together. Salutes were exchanged, but neither wanted to offer a hand first.
You are Alexeyev, General Robinson said. I expected someone else.
Marshal Bukharin is in retirement.
Your Russian is excellent, General Robinson.
Thank you, General Alexeyev. Some years ago I got interested in the plays of Chekhov. You can really understand a play only in its original language. Since then, I have read a good deal of Russian literature. Alexeyev nodded. The better to understand your enemy. He went on in English. Very sensible of you. Shall we take a walk? How many men do you have in the trees? A platoon of motor riflemen. Alexeyev switched back to his native language. Robinson's mastery of Russian was better than his of English, and Pasha had made his point. How were we to know what would come out of the helicopter?
True, Sakyur conceded.
Yet you were standing out in the open, to show me that you are fearless.
What shall we talk about?
A termination of hostilities, perhaps.
I am listening.
You know, of course, that I had no part in starting this madness.
Robinson's head turned.
What soldier ever does, General? We merely shed the blood and get the blame. Your father was a soldier, was he not?
A tanker.
He was luckier than your father.
That's often what it is, isn't it? Luck.
We should not tell our political leaders that.
Alexeyev almost ventured a smile until he saw that he'd given Robinson an opening.
Who are your political leaders? If we are to reach a workable agreement, I must be able to tell mine who is in charge.
The General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union is Mikhail Eduardovich Sergeyev.
Who?
Sakyur wondered. He did not remember the name. He'd refreshed his memory on all the full Politburo members, but that name wasn't on the list. He temporized.
What the hell happened?
Alexeyev saw the puzzlement on Robinson's face, and this time he did venture a smile. You do not know who he is, do you, Comrade General? There is an unknown for you to ponder. As you Americans are fond of saying, it was time for a change.
Who taught you to play poker, son? Sakyur wondered. But I'm holding aces over kings. What are you holding?
What is your proposal?
I do not know how to be a diplomat, only how to be a soldier, Alexeyev said. We propose a ceasefire in place, followed by a phased withdrawal to pre-war positions over a period of 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks I can achieve that without a ceasefire, Robinson said coldly.
At great cost, and greater risk, the Russian pointed out.
We know that you are short of fuel. Your entire national economy could come apart.
Yes, General Robinson. And if our army comes apart, as you say, we have only one defense option to safeguard the state.
Your country has launched a war of aggression against the NATO alliance. Do you suppose that we can let you return to status quo ante, nothing else?
Sakyur asked quietly. He was keeping close rein on his emotions. He'd already made one slip, and that was too many.
And don't tell me about the Kremlin bomb plot. You know sure as hell we had no part of that.
I have told you that I had no part in this. I follow orders. But did you expect the Politburo to sit still while our national economy ground to a halt? What political pressure would you have put on us, eh? If you knew about our oil shortage?
We didn't until a few days ago.
The Maskarovka worked?
Why didn't you tell us you needed oil? Robinson asked.
And you would have given it to us?
Robinson, I do not have your degree in international relations, but I am not so much of a fool as that.
We would have demanded and gotten concessions of some kind. But don't you think we would have tried to prevent all this?
Alexeyev tore a leaf off a tree. He stared at it for a moment, the marvelous networking of veins, everything interconnected with everything else.
You have just killed another living thing, Pasha.
I suppose the Politburo never thought about that.
They launched a war of aggression, Robinson repeated. How many are dead because of them?
The men who made that decision are under arrest. They will be tried in a people's court for crimes against the state. Comrade Sergeyev spoke against the war and has risked his life, as have I, to bring it to a just end.
We want them.
We will reconvene the Nuremberg Tribunal and try them for crimes against humanity.
You may have them only after we are finished with them. It will be a dull trial, General Robinson, Alexeyev added. Both men were now talking like soldiers, not diplomats.
You think your